morning. How you guys doing? I told them that I was going to do this. What's up? These are my people over here. So I told them on Monday, I was like, hey, if you guys show up to 11 a.m., I'm just going to just look right over at you and just say, I love you. Thank you for being here. So thanks for being here. All right. My name is Caleb, for those of you who don't know me, and I am the director of high school ministries here, and it's so fun. It's awesome, and I'm excited to share with you guys this morning. Are you guys ready to get into it? You guys ready? Let's go. So we are so hyped. So we are in a series. We're actually wrapping up. This is the last week of a series called The Goat, and it's based off the teachings of Jesus found in Matthew 5-7. And it's the Sermon on the Mount. It's actually the collection of some of Jesus' greatest teachings. I bet you he would say it is his greatest teachings. It's kind of like his thesis or his book, really, right? It's like actually the new law. So like Moses had this law with hundreds and hundreds of laws that was so difficult to uphold. And Jesus comes in and brings the new law, which is the Sermon on the Mount and the life that he lives. And we are wrapping up the Sermon on the Mount series. And what's really funny about Jesus is he doesn't end the Sermon on the Mount with like a pep talk or a funny story or a little like three-part action step dealio like we would do here. Instead, he ends it with a warning. It's a warning. And it's found in Matthew chapter 7, starting at verse 24. The warning is this: therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house. Yet it did not fall because it had the foundation on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice, this is the warning, is like a foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain came down, and the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash. When Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching because he taught as someone who had authority and not as the teachers of their law. Will you guys pray with me before we get started? God, thank you just for the opportunity to speak here. God, I'm just reminded of the passage in 1 Corinthians where you say, if anything is outside of love, it sounds like a gong symbol. And so God, I just come before you and I ask you that you would build in me the love that you have for these people, and that the words that I say would not be of me, but they would be of your Spirit, God. We love you. In Jesus' name. And everyone said. So there's this guy, his name's Neil Postman. Neil Postman is a cultural commentator and a media critic. And in 1985, he wrote the book, Amusing Ourselves to Death. And in the book, he coined this term. The term is called the information to action ratio. And what he means by that is how much information that we take in versus how much we put it into action. Have you guys noticed that we have a lot of information that comes in? Yeah, too much. And think about it, this book was written in 1985. This is before phones. So he's like, there's too much information and we don't do anything about it. But he said that we used to. Look at this quote in his book. He says, the tie between information and action has been severed. It doesn't exist really anymore. We're glutted with information. We're drowning in information. We have no control over it, and we don't know what to do with it. And what's very interesting is he doesn't point to like the invention of a computer as the point where we started to receive too much information. No, he goes all the way back to the telegraph. He said the telegraph is the point where we were able to reach the entire globe with information and news at lightning speeds, quickly. And he said, before the telegraph, all the information and news, good or bad, that we received would be like local news or, yeah, something happened in your town. And odds are, like, you would live in a small town. And so if you heard news about your neighbor's barn being on fire, you would not, like, post a Instagram thing and be like, no more barn fires. Like, this generation is going to end barn fires forever. Like, no. You would get your bucket and you would walk, you would do something. You got information and you would put it into action. You would get your bucket and you'd fill it with water and then you'd go and put the fire out. The point is this. Silly analogy to say, we used to do things with the information that we received. We used to. I mean, and just think of the last few weeks. How much information there has been with what's going on in Afghanistan, with what's going on with COVID-19, with what's going on in the political environment. I swear, there was an earthquake in Haiti. And it was like I saw one Instagram post and nothing else. It was just information, 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 information. It's an onslaught. And most of us, if we're being honest with ourselves, we take in all the information and we don't do anything with it. We don't. And Postman said it creates this cycle in our heads. We get lots and lots and lots of information. In fact, we're overloaded by it. And then what's interesting is each one of us is moved by it. Like we want to do something. What can we do? What can we do? But then we don't do anything. You might be wondering, what does this have to do with the Sermon on the Mount? Well, look at the first line of the last teaching on the Sermon on the Mount. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine, who takes in the information that I just gave you and puts them into practice is like, and puts them into action. The cultural norm is to take information and do nothing with it. And Jesus is addressing the culture that we live in today and is saying, what will you do, CPC, with the information that I just gave you? What information? What is he talking about? The entire Sermon on the Mount. Therefore, anyone who hears these words of mine, anyone who just listened to my teaching, and we all had a summer of his teaching. It says, anyone who hears what I just said and puts them into practice is like, and then he uses a metaphor to describe what happens. He's saying it's not enough to just listen. We have to do something about it. We got to put it into practice. James, who's Jesus' half-brother, says it a little bit harsher in James 2:14. He says this, what use is it, my brothers and sisters, if someone says he has faith but no works? It's a rhetorical question. It's useless. There is no use. And it seems like really strict and really behavioral driven, and I don't mean it to sound like that. Like, we need to come to God in a posture of love to obey him. But he's pretty serious about us obeying him. And I always ask myself, anytime I get, like I'm preaching or I'm going over something or I feel like God's revealing something to me, I always ask him why. Like, why do I do that? I'm like a little kid, you know? Why? And why? You know what I'm saying? He goes, whatever. So he's like, I ask why. And the why that he gave me was this. Jesus' end goal is not to inform you, but to transform you. Jesus' end goal is not to inform you, but to transform you. And every single person in this room wants to change. I know that. You wouldn't be here if you didn't, unless your parents forced you to come. But you want to change. You want to grow. And ideally, you want to grow into someone who's more like Jesus. You want to grow into someone who's an image bearer of God. And Jesus is saying pretty clearly, if you follow my teachings, if you put them into practice, you will become made into my likeness. You will become the person that you were created to be. You will become the truest version of humanity, which is an image bearer of me. And it's possible. Just put it into practice. So what we're going to do for the remainder of our time is we're going to look at this parable that he uses. And I used to think that I would put things in three to like help you guys understand what was, but I realized it's actually more for me for like structure, you know? So we're going to look at three different observations, and it's these ones right here. We're going to look at the houses in the parable, the people, and the storm. The houses, the people, and the storm. First one, the houses. So in Jesus's day, in first century AD, in like a Roman environment, homes were built. They were not bought and sold. And oftentimes they were multi-generational, and where you built them was based off of where you worked. So if you were a fisherman, you would build your home by a sea. If you were a farmer, you would build your home on the farm. If you worked in the marketplace off, like probably your home is near town or in town. So when Jesus says, those who build their house on the rock or on the sand, he's actually making a reference to your life. Saying those who build their life on the rock or their life on the sand. And what's similar, if you notice in the parable, it was kind of a mirror. The house on the sand and the house on the rock experienced the exact same storm, which shows us something about the parable, that these are similar looking homes, right? And I was thinking about how we are all similar looking people. We all go to the same church. Some of us have similar jobs. Some of us have similar looking kids, have similar the kids that go to the same school. Some of us go to the same school as other people. It's like our homes or our lives look really similar to each other's at a distance. But when you get up close, what's revealed is what the home is built on. What's the foundation of the home? What do you put your hope in? What do you put your security in? What do you put your trust in? That's what he's saying. Is it on the rock or is it on sand? I noticed that in our community, there's a few things that I see that people will put their trust and their build their foundation on. And one of them is achievements. It's like the businesses that we own or the businesses that we work for or how much money we have and make. It's the education that we hold. It's how popular we are. It's how people view us on social media. It's our achievements. It's who, it's like what we put out in front of people, what we show the world that we are. Other people build it on like hedonism or materialism, pleasure, on how much stuff we have, how many homes we have, where our homes are, what we like to buy. You know, like my kids shop at Vineyard Vines. It's like we build it on these things that are just fleeting in a sense. No against, nothing against Vineyard Vines, sorry. Or we build it on a political ideology, who we voted for, what bill we want passed, what president we want, what governor we want, what we want to do internationally, what we want to do nationally. And some of these things are really important. Like it's important where you work. It's important what happens in government. But Jesus is saying, do you put your trust in it? Do you put your, you build your house on it? You put all your security in it? You build your life on that? Like, that's sand. That's sand. And when the storm comes, what will be revealed is what you build your life on. And if it's on him, it's a rock. And if it's not on him, if it's anything else, it's sand. It's sand. I had this image like when I used to go to the beach. Like I remember like me and my brothers, we'd build sandcastles, right? And you want to be like pretty close to the water because you want the nice firm sand. And I remember just building like moats around my castle trying to protect the castle that I had just built. And I have this moment, like I have this memory where I remember just like holding on to my sandcastle because this giant wave came and just washed it away. And Jesus is like, it'll be washed away. It's going to be a big crash. It's a warning. And it's so important for us to know to know why we need to build our lives on the rock. It's not just for your own spiritual growth and maturity. This affects your families. This affects the people around you. Because the crash is going to come and he's like, what will you be built on? If it's not built on me, it's going to be a great crash. That's the first thing. The houses are more like what they're built on. The second one is the people. And notice the two words he uses to describe the people. The first one is wise man, and the second one is foolish man. Wise man, foolish man. Jesus just splits the room and cuts right to the core of people. The word wise could be translated in the original language intelligent, smart, in touch with reality. And the one that I think is like the most important is thoughtful. It's thoughtful. Foolish man, however, can be translated the inverse, unintelligent, not smart, not thoughtful, not in touch with reality. And I was reflecting on the people of our church, and you are a thoughtful people, all of you. We invest our money so well, and we plan for our retirements and our college funds, and we do so many things to build a firm foundation. But Jesus is like, you know what the most thoughtful thing to do is? Build your life on me, on my teachings, on my way of life, on the fruit of the Spirit, on the teachings that I lay out for you in the Bible. If not, and it's built on something else, it's not wise. He's being clear. Life built on him, wise. Life built on anything but him, foolish. It's foolish. One of the many things that I love about Jesus is he's brutally honest with the human condition. What I mean by that is this. Life is hard. It's hard. And if you're wise, you know it's hard. And so you're thoughtful to build your house on the rock. If you're not, you weren't that thoughtful. You weren't expecting the storm to come for some reason. When you expect life to be easy, it's way more difficult. If you expect life to be hard, it's way easier. Jesus doesn't promise that you won't get the storm. He promises that he will get you through it. Through the storm. I have a really good friend of mine. She's amazing. When she was in high school, she got offered full ride scholarships to play soccer, and she ended up choosing Pepperdine University to play Division I soccer. She ended up graduating from Pepperdine with a master's degree in finance, and now she is just like this beast, like marketplace woman, you know? And like, she's already so cool, and you know, she's just gonna get cooler and cooler and cooler as the years go on. But what people don't know about her is that the storm of her life came when she was a freshman in college. See, she played soccer, and then she got injured. And the injury wasn't just kind of like, oh, I'm gonna get through this. It was a career-ending back injury. And it's been 5, 6, 7 years, I don't know how long, since the injury, and she still is feeling the effects. And so a few weeks back, we had like some people over to do like a little small group, like house church style setting. And in during the time, she asked for prayer for her back because she's getting married in 2 weeks. And she'd like to walk down the aisle. And so of course, we're like, yes. Like, we're gonna pray for you, right? So we all like lay hands on her back and start praying that God would just heal her back. And a day later, a couple days later, she responds in a group message with all of our friends, like the community that we're in. And in response to the prayer that we had, she said this. She said, there are some mornings that I can't even walk around the house, and physically I can feel my body breaking down. She's 26 years old. I knew soccer was just a season of my life, but I had hoped to play overseas, eventually make the national pool, and maybe even play pro in the United States. Could you imagine? I keep my struggle with my back and the anxiety it causes me private, because another thing God has shown me is that everyone has an area of vulnerability, and it's not all about me. I see now that it took a career-ending injury and debilitating health for God to show me that the greatest achievement I will ever find in my life is knowing him. When I was physically strong and in peak condition, my faith was weak. It's easy to praise God when you're being offered full-ride scholarships to top universities, when you have the self-confidence in your appearance, and when everybody wants to be your friend. It's much harder to see God when you feel like you have nothing to offer and no value left. But it was in that specific place that God told me who he wanted me to be. I stopped living for myself. I stopped listening to the world. I jeopardized my reputation for the sake of knowing him and started surrendering my life to something and someone much greater. In the place where I feel like I had nothing, I gained everything. And knowing the one person in this world who loved me, who will love me, even if I am nothing,
And that level of love has changed my life forever. This response is much longer than expected, but in summary, during the prayer last night, God revealed the way he has grown in me in the time since my injury. This is the line. And the miracle he already performed is healing my heart. So good. And then she ends with this passage, Matthew 16:26. What good will it be for someone to gain the whole world, yet forfeit their soul? There are wise and there are foolish. There's in touch with reality. There's out of touch with reality. There's thoughtful and there's not thoughtful. And the storm in my friend's life revealed where her foundation was, where her hopes in, where her security is placed. It's not in her achievements. And it could be. She's amazing. But it's in him. I was thinking about how people would respond to something like that. For my friend, the response was just like, all I want to do is know Jesus. All I want to do is know God. Some other people would be like, God, you took my dreams away. That's what I wanted to do. You hate me. And then the feeling that they would have would like overcome their body, and then this like angst would just be broadcast all over their community. A great crash. Proverbs 10:25. When the whirlwind passes by, the wicked is no more, but the righteous has an everlasting foundation. All right, last thing, the storm. The storm is obviously, clearly referencing something that's going to be devastating. And notice that Jesus doesn't say if, instead he implies when. That's what he's saying. When the storm comes, when the storm comes. His words ring true. He says this later on in the Gospels. He says, you will have trouble in this world. You will. It's a promise. And the storm is going to be revealing. It's either going to be this beautiful moment of like character building and living in the way of Jesus and pursuing after things of God, or it's going to be devastating. That word great crash is where we get the word mega. Mega crash. And what you build your life on, it might not be directly related to the storm. But what you will realize is that the thing that you placed your security and your hope and your trust in is sand. It doesn't hold up. Let me give you an example. You place your life and your hope in the achievements, the businesses that you've built, the money that you've made, the status that you hold. But then if your spouse leaves you, and your kids hate you, that might not be directly related to what you did. It could be. But no amount of achievement or success is ever going to get your family back. Or if you've placed your life and your hope in pleasure and money and the possession of things, but then a family member dies, no amount of stuff can comfort you. But if you place your hope in Jesus, and if any one of these situations comes, you have a comforter, you have a counselor, you have one that you can go to who fills you with hope and peace, like Romans 15 says. The storm is like when your life seems to crash. Some of us have experienced this already. When your life crashes all around you. I was reminded last service while I was teaching of 1 Timothy 5:24 that says, the sins of some are obvious. The sins of others trail behind them. What does he mean? Sometimes it's a big crash. It's clear. It's obvious. Other times it's a slow drip. Just a little bit of anger. And then it just destroys the relationships in your nuclear family. Here's the point. No one is immune to the storm. No one. And I'm being pretty firm, but it's because I believe that the warning of Jesus should wake us up. Should wake us up and have ourselves take a long, hard look at our lives and ask this question: what am I building my life on? What am I building my life on? And if you're wondering, like, how can I tell? What's the gauge to know if I'm building my life on the sand or the rock? Well, remember the first line. The first line of the teaching. Therefore, anyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like. So you take the information that you receive from Jesus and you do something about it. I need to be clear. The way of Jesus is not a thought. It's not an ideology, and it's definitely not information. It's literally more like a sport. You have to try, you have to train, you have to grow, you have to practice. It's a lifestyle. I was thinking, Tyler last week, he mentioned this I am statement that Jesus says, where Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. That's what he emphasized. He's the way, he's the gate. But Jesus is a master. Because he also, if you emphasize a different word, he's the way, the truth, and the life. He's a lifestyle. And everything that we do, the work that we put into these Sunday morning gatherings is to equip you, to grow you into being someone who lives a lifestyle of pursuing after Jesus. And like, seriously, think about it. Did you go to the worry one like a few weeks back and then just never worry again? No. It's not how it works. It's a lifestyle. You grow and don't take, I'm 26 with a mic. Like, that's all. Take it from someone older than me. Ask anybody who's older than me and they'll be like, yes, this is a lifestyle. You grow into it. And every single day, God is showing me and revealing things and teaching me. Remember, Jesus' end goal is not to inform you, but to transform you. The informed hears the words of Jesus and does not put them into practice. That's what the informed person does. They build their house on sand. The transformed person hears the words of Jesus and puts them into practice. Neil Postman says the cultural norm is to receive information and be overloaded by it, and then to be moved by it. Like, we're all moved to do something when we come to church on Sunday. But it's also the cultural norm to do nothing with it. Here's the clarifier that I need to add. It's John 14:15. If you love me, you will obey my commandments. If you love me, if you love me. This isn't a slide, but I want you to catch this. So I'll repeat it a couple times. Love does not follow behavior. Behaviors follow love. Love does not follow behavior. Behaviors follow love. When I was a kid, I didn't do what my parents said because they're my parents. Like, sometimes. But I did it because I loved them. And if I didn't love them, I would just disobey them. I wouldn't care. And in the same way, the Father is asking you, do you love me? Because I love you. And the tools and the things that I'm putting in place, the Sermon on the Mount, the reason why I sent my son was not to get you to heaven. That's something you're missing. It's to get heaven inside of you. Do you love God? Does anybody love God? Then do something about it. Then do it. Put it in to practice. We just had a summer of teachings on the Sermon on the Mount. And we had things that we were prompted with Jesus, to forgive people, to give, not just our resources, but our time, right? To pray, to ask with shameless audacity, banging on the door, to love our enemies, to fast. Like, nobody fasts anymore. Why? It's a teaching of Jesus. Why don't we do that? To not worry, to not judge, to be the salt of the world. Like, we were shown and taught all of these things this summer. And so how I want to end this service is with a moment of silence. A time where we can sit in the stillness, in the presence of God. Because you don't need to hear me talk anymore. You don't. You need to pray and ask God to prompt you. What do you want me to do? What do you want me to put into practice? Do you want me to forgive? Do you want me to love? Do you want me to ask? Do you want me to do? Do you want me to, like, is there something in the fruit of the Spirit that you're trying to show me? So we're going to spend a few minutes, and what I want you to do is just sit in the stillness and invite God into the conversation and say, what do you want me to do? Sometimes it's a nudge. Sometimes it's loud and clear. But it's like, for me, I like to, like, imagine I'm sitting at, like, a park bench and Jesus just comes and sits next to me. And just tells me, this is where I want you to work. This is what I want you to do. So we could just sit in that for a few minutes. So invite the Spirit to come in and ask him to prompt us into doing something. So God, we invite you to come, and will you just come and rest on us, Lord? Would you show us what to do? Because God, we want to build our life on you. Thank you for the time that we have here. Thank you, God, that you send your Spirit to comfort us, to counsel us, to convict us, to encourage us, God. Jesus, I pray that by the power of your Spirit, whatever you prompt them to do, God, you will help them to fulfill. You help them to do it. We love you, God. In Jesus' name, amen.